This is Hockey Central with Jeff Merrick, Anthony Stewart, and Justin Bourne on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
Okay, you guys remember how to do this? Familiar with this? Everybody's back. Everyone's well refreshed.
Maybe back. I didn't go anywhere. I've been here.
No, I know. You've been here the whole time. Welcome to Hockey Central. The crew is back. Jeff Merrick alongside Anthony Stewart and Justin Bourne. Before we jump in with hockey, and there's a lot of it, Elliot Friedman's going to drop by in 20 minutes or so. I got to give it up to you, Anthony Stewart. You talked about it. We laughed about it. And then you did it. You know what I'm talking about?
What's up?
That picture that you sent out on our group WhatsApp of your Christmas feast, complete with the, as I like to call it, spaghetti cake, which other people refer to as lasagna. The Christmas lasagna. That's what puts it over the top for me.
I'm telling you, that when I've been to Italy, I've been to Sicily, I've been everywhere. When I say my sister has the best lasagna in the league, by far the best, I'm still eating it. It's like how many days? It's
that tray was huge.
It's mold proof. I'm still
eating
it.
How many people were at that dinner?
There was probably 40 people.
Okay.
So the Stewart household is known to throw a party. Yeah. There may be some root beers involved. But we've known to throw a good party, especially over the holidays.
Nice. It looked great. That spread looked fantastic.
Oh, yeah. And that's what it's about. The holidays is about people coming together, telling stories, and having a good time.
Lasagna.
Who would have thought?
How was yours, Borny?
Just
Kelowna
fantastic.
Boy?
Fantastic. Yeah, no, we had just the right amount of snowfall, got the kid outside, had the no lasagna, unfortunately, but mom also does a mean spread, so yeah, it was
nice.
Fantastic.
That's awesome. Okay, let's jump in with the hockey then. Enough of the formalities, and it's a back to business now, gentlemen. Jump in with the Fast Five. We'll start off with the Toronto Maple Leafs and the weekend that was. It was Friday, New Jersey, a win there. Saturday, an overtime loss at the hands of the New York Rangers. What stood out on the Fast Five for the Maple Leafs weekend?
Well, I think the offense both ways. You know, this is a team that going into this year, it was the focus was going to be on playoffs and trying to win in playoffs. And, you know, that style of hockey, people, I don't think you would associate that with playoff hockey and winning hockey. Even Sheldon Keefe, after one of their games, said that, you know, there wasn't a whole lot to like about that game, except we got the 2 points. So that's important for them right now. They need to win, even if they don't like how it's getting done. I'm not sure if that's a sustainable way to win, but they did win. What also stood out was just the injuries. I mean, they lost Mikheyev, Muzzin out with a broken foot now.
Week to week.
And week to week, yeah. So there is a very real reason to look at this lineup and say, what now? They're going to play some better teams, and they're going to be calling on a lot of their depth.
I have a quick thought on the Maple Leafs before we jump right back.
Is there a trade on the horizon? There's got to be, no.
Well,
you can't have these many quality players out.
We'll talk to Elliot Friedman about that.
I coined a new phrase when you guys were gone. It's Hail Mary hockey. And the Leafs have been doing that as of late, where they're making the Hail Mary passes. They're just going running and gunning. But what I didn't really like about the Ranger game was they got some running gunners. Zibanejad was the best player on the ice from puck drop to the end of the game. And how do you let Panarin just go in on a 2-on-1 at the end of the game thinking, he's not going to make a play? These guys are elite. So it's very entertaining, but they got to manage who they're playing against at certain times of the game.
All right, more on the Maple Leafs here in a couple of moments. Meanwhile, the Edmonton Oilers, it is tough for Edmonton right now. It wasn't that long ago we looked at Edmonton and said, wow, look at that. They're on top. Look at that. Just like that, a couple of tiny little moves, and the Edmonton Oilers are on top, and they've turned. Oh, boy.
And you guys predicted this, and I was the biggest Edmonton stan saying there's no way they got the right now. Again, it still looks, it doesn't look too promising, but they still got the league's eighth best penalty kill, the first best power play. But their last little bit, there's no way to dice it. They only got 4 wins in December. They've lost 2 in a row. They lost 4 of the last 5. 8 of the last 10, only 4 total wins in December. But what's is sort of disappointing to me now is we talked about McDavid and Drysdale providing the primary, secondary, and looking for guys to get to tertiary scoring.
Boom.
Cassian Neal, 1 goal in their last 5. McDavid only has 2 goals in the last 5 games. Drysdale, 4 points in their last 5 games. So they're not really scoring as much as they used to. And right now, it's not good at Edmonton.
4-10-1 in their last 15. So here's the thing about the Oilers we've been talking about. 5-on-5 this season, they've just been okay.
Yeah.
Their power play, got it done. Save percentage, got it done. Both those two things have normalized, and what are you left with now in Edmonton?
Reality.
So if you're Ken Holland, we'll get into this more a little bit later on. If you're Ken Holland, I know we always have this discussion about the plan and stick to the plan, and this is their plan, and Ken Holland has a plan, and everyone signed off on the plan. You gonna false start them again this year? Or if you're Ken, is the only way out of this a trade or trades?
Yeah, they got to make two or three, but can they do that at this juncture, this point of the season, this point where their cap situation is? I think this is something they have to address in the offseason. So this, we're talking about the long-term plan. Does it make sense to make one trade now to have them squeak into the playoffs and lose first round?
Well, that's the question here is, how honest are you being with yourself? If you say, boy, we can't be bad again. We can't, you know, blow that start. We need to make a trade to get into playoffs. And then you sacrifice some piece of what could be a foundation in the future for short term. You just kind of perpetuate the cycle. So they kind of need to be honest. And is the season lost? It's not lost, but boy, it's in real trouble. And when are you trying to win? I don't think you're going for a cup this year. So you kind of have to be realistic, and maybe it's farther down the road.
Okay, Alexander Ovechkin saying, I'm not going to go to the All-Star game. I need to be fresh for the second half of the season because, as we all know, All-Star weekend is very taxing on hockey players.
Yeah, I want to say the right things and be like, well, he's been around. It's his 13th, 14th year, and he deserves. No, it's the All-Star game. Just go. Just go to the All-Star game and you don't have to try that hard and shake some hands, sign some autographs. The league has done a ton of great things for you and your family and your life. This is one of the few events they ask you to be at and do the right thing. So I think you got to go. But part of the problem here is I hate the way the All-Star game picks the team or the league picks their All-Star teams. I loathe the idea that every team has to send someone because, you know, having the Red Wings send a player and the Senators, all right, maybe Duclair is legit, but yeah. You know, having Dylan Larkin go instead of someone's going to miss out, who's a name, whether it be a Matthews or a Marner, and not just the Toronto guys, but a Huberto or a Barkov, someone is going to miss out because you have to send someone from every team, which devalues the concept of being an All-Star and devalues it to the players who go, why do I go anyway? It's not even an All-Star game.
See, I disagree with that. And here's why. You're taking it from the point of view that the All-Star game is for you. It's not. One of my greatest revelations, and it took me a long time to get there, and listen, I'm not some guy with expanded vision and wisdom on all this, but it took me, because I used to grouse about the All-Star game all the time. Trust me, guys. There was no bigger critic of the All-Star game than me until something dawned on me. I got out of my own way, and I realized that this thing wasn't for me. Mm-hmm. Not everything in sports, life, certainly hockey, has to be for us. All-Star game is for kids and for sponsors as a way to say thank you for keeping the lights on.
Right.
But why not make it for the players?
What's that?
Why not make it for the players also? Why not have it in Hawaii? Why not have it in Puerto Rico or somewhere where it'll be great to go bring your family for a couple of days and have the incentive for them to go there and perform because it's in a nice, warm, the family can have a good time.
Yeah.
That's something where it can make it more incentivized for the players.
That's for a secondary conversation, but this one is for the kids. Like, mm-hmm. Are we all on the same page that All-Star game is for the kids? You look at the kids' faces of those people that are at the arena and they see all the stars, like all the superstars, all on the same rink. Or they watch it on television, and they see their local guy mixing with all these dudes.
I still think you'd rather see the all-stars. You'd rather see the best players in the league there.
As a kid.
I would absolutely. I think you can make.
If you're a kid in Detroit, would you rather see Dylan Larkin or the third Boston Bruin that's going to go?
I mean, me or
no,
being intelligent?
Again, this is not for you.
Right. No, I understand that.
It's not for you.
But I mean the kid. I'm the kid in Detroit. He just made me the kid in Detroit.
Big pet peeve of mine still is people in our industry, in media, you know, like middle-aged dudes like me grousing about the All-Star game.
Hey, God, listen, I'm not oblivious to that. I'm saying the kids want All-Stars. The kids don't want pseudo All-Stars because they're wearing the same jersey, do they?
To a kid growing up in Detroit who watches the Detroit Red Wings, Dylan Larkin to them is an all-star.
Right.
So I have no problem with Dylan Larkin going instead of the third Bruin.
Sure.
I don't mind it.
That's a fair point.
You win.
Whoa.
Radio just ended.
Wait a minute.
All of sports radio just
ended. That's not talk radio. You're supposed to yell at me and insult me somehow. That's not supposed to end like that. More on the all-star game in a couple of minutes. The Vancouver Canucks. And through all of this, has Jacob Markstrom now become stealth Vezina candidate?
He had 49 saves.
What a performance.
49 saves the other night against LA, and the Vancouver fans started a fight in my mentions after the Toronto game, how long ago that was, and it just finished. So I have to give credit where credit's due, that the Vancouver Canucks, they're the real deal, because just like how we were talking a couple, you know, probably 10 days ago about Edmonton being the real deal, we sort of counted Vancouver Canucks out. But they put together a little win streak here, and four of those five wins were against teams in their actual division, the division rivals. So the Vancouver Canucks right now, they're the real deal. And what I like about it is it's a lot of topsy-turvy right now. After we're counting teams out, we're planning the parade for one team. Week to week, it's a different team. But Vancouver Canucks, especially with Markstrom, the way he's playing, they're the real deal. And you know what? I'm going to eat a little bit of crow here because I didn't really give them a chance to be making the playoffs. I thought They were a year away, but they're proving me wrong.
But no, but you still might ultimately be right, though, through all of this, Stewie. Like, I think that I look at this division and I say two are probably spoken for. Mm-hmm. Vegas and Arizona. And after that, honestly, I just think it's going to be a dogfight for that last spot.
I'll give you Vegas for sure. But yeah,
You're not giving me Arizona?
No, not, I'm not yet to.
But they got Taylor Hall.
That. I know. He's a nice player.
They just lost to Dallas, Jeffy.
I think that goaltending papers over some issues pretty nicely. Goaltending is at the root of so many streaks.
Yeah.
You know, the Canucks over these five wins, they've been outshot by a total of 47 shots. So it's not like they've been dominating play, but Markstrom's been fantastic. Like you mentioned, that goes such a long way. The Oilers, who have not been as good, they stopped getting goaltending. You know, I don't know how much of team play we can assign to goaltending. Like, did the Oilers start playing not as well, and so the saves got harder for them for more dangerous spots? And maybe it's vice versa with Vancouver. Maybe the shots got easier and more from the outside. But as goaltending goes, your team goes. And right now, the Canucks are getting goaltending.
They are. And we'll close on this one. And I'd like to play the audio. Do we have this handy? We do. You know, when his career is finally done, there's going to be a really awesome greatest hits compilation for John Tortorella. It's going to be spectacular. And he wrote another hit single yesterday after his team lost in shootout style to the Chicago Blackhawks. Here's John Tortorella.
The whistle is blown at 19.2 on the clock. For some reason, the clock has run down a second and a tenth to 18.1. For whatever reason, I have no idea. So instead of resetting the clock, we have them tell our captain we're not going to do it. Toronto doesn't step in. Refs don't do their freaking job. And now we lose the game and we lose our goalie. So the chain of events, if it was done right, we don't lose our goalie, we win the hockey game. So all this god technology, right? The technology and getting things right, the stubbornness tonight by the officials and by the league and Toronto, however it's supposed to work, screws us.
And followed it up with, I'm not taking any questions.
I think it's fascinating that he mixed a freaking in there. Like,
if you're going for it, really go for it. Like, why soften it at that point? If you're in for a penny, in for a pound, John,
right.
Just go for it.
Yeah. There's a certain type of person who talks themselves more angry, and it's like him hearing himself like, oh, yeah, we also lost our goalie because of this. Like, he really worked himself into a nice lather there. But he's right. He's right. They got totally screwed and totally unjustly screwed. And this is a team that has points in 10 straight games.
Yeah.
That is now 6 points out of a playoff spot. It could have been five. He's coaching for his job there. I mean, those points, that point might matter if they have a really good second half like it looks like they might be able to have. And they got straight up hosed. And the league should come out and say as much.
But what did Toronto do? It's calling out Toronto as a city or the video department. Yeah.
I don't know if they would even have the option to be like, whoa, stop the game, you know, but they did kind of get screwed there.
So whistle at 19.2, it actually goes to 18.1 on the clock. So you're pooched by a 1.1 second.
And they scored what, 0.1
after the buzzer? Zach Werenski scored, I think it's 0.3, right? So it's like, it's real quick. Everyone in that nation went, oh, they scored. Yeah, it was just fantastic. And no, it's callback. That's not the game winner. They go to overtime, solves nothing. Go to shootout, Jonathan Toews, Jonas Korpisalo, and he's injured, and Elvis Merzlikins. How'd you like to be Elvis Merzlikins?
Just come
in. Julie the Cat Gaffney, get in there.
He comes in, and who's the first shooter he sees? Patrick Kane.
Yeah. Yeah. Who basically coming did the full shimmy shake on
Kane
the way down.
Kane comes in full speed. He's got the side brakes going. Did you see that?
Yeah.
You got to get ISO cam on the side brakes. Comes in and just roofs it backhand. Thanks for coming.
So I do understand his point. And technically, he's right. Should have gone to 19 too.
A game of inches.
And so is he supposed to, what's Tortorella supposed to do after the game? I know he's not supposed to do that. I understand. But is he supposed to do the NFL protect the shield and go, boy, sometimes you just get unlucky. I know, like, they got screwed, and it really matters to someone who's competitive and wants to win.
I understand the frustration.
Yeah.
I really do. I understand frustration. I know the NHL doesn't want to get, you know, once you open the door and say, well, okay, well, that's fine what John Tortorella did, then it's you turn that tap on, you can't turn it off. So I get it, but was anything that he said dishonest? Now, he may have put a lot of salt on it as he got there, but was anything
picking up steam? Like,
it comes from a place of honesty, essentially what I'm trying to
and
get.
I think I saw on Twitter that they're going to start a GoFundMe account just to pay the fine.
For John Tortorella fines?
Yeah. I'm in. I'll donate. I'll chip on that.
So there you go. There's the Fast Five. Things that caught our eyeballs over the weekend. One thing that we probably should have put on there too, but it's not the quick six, it's the Fast Five. How about the St. Louis Blues? 8 games in a row, a pair against the Winnipeg Jets. David Perron, the OT hero, he's been fantastic this year for St. Louis in game one. In game two, Jaden Schwartz with the pair as well. This is a team that is a buzzsaw right now. And as we always have to add, the caveat here is they're doing it all without Vladimir Tarasenko.
Yeah, and it's not like they got an easy schedule. Eight of those wins twice against Winnipeg. They beat Edmonton. They beat Colorado. They beat the Vegas Golden Knights, who are playing good hockey as of late. So Jordan Binnington's playing great. Jake Gallen stepping in, playing some big games. So St. Louis Blues, they're not slowing down. I think they're the Vegas Golden Knights of last year, where they haven't come back down. They're still flying high since that Stanley Cup win ever since last year in February. They're definitely the real deal.
So then here becomes a question, because many people, and I was one of them too, that was skeptical whether they could come back this season and come anywhere close to what we saw at the end of last year and certainly into the playoffs. And they have, and they're tops in the Central, and they're one of the elite teams in the NHL. And once again, a legitimate contender for the Stanley Cup. They might repeat. They are that good. So I keep coming back to this one thing then. Considering there hasn't been, you know, much turnover. Sure, Pat Maroon goes, and now he's with Tampa. What happened at the beginning of last year?
Yeah.
Like the coach.
But the thing is, it was more than that. Like, we keep hearing at the beginning of last season about this, how the St. Louis bench was terrible. And guys are screaming at each other. And it is just an awful situation all around. But going into the season, I mean, I remember Kiprios picked him to win the Stanley Cup. And we all said, yeah, good pick, Kip.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that makes some sense. Finally, they'll break the curse.
Well, along
kick the jinx.
With the Berube hire was Binnington didn't come around till January, and they weren't getting goaltending. And I know I'm not saying that all hockey success is related to that, but I mean, it gives you some belief when you believe the guy in net is going to do his job and hold up his end of the bargain. I think that went a long way.
I think this just goes to show how much respect Craig Berube has. And a lot of people, you know, he was a great assistant coach over the years, but he held guys accountable. And he gives you a look. He's a guy that's played. So when a guy has played the game and tells you to go out and play tough or play the right way, he's a guy that did it. So you have to listen to a guy like that. But you know, they got Mike Van Ryan, they got Steve Ock, guys that have played the game. So
Mark Savard comes
in.
Yeah,
they got a good complement of coaching staff, guys that have been there. So it's a lot different when you have a guy that's been there, been through the trenches, has won at that level, to really, you really listen to guys like that.
You know what's interesting about that? You just mentioned all the coaches, and it's not just Craig Berube. These are all old school guys that are thriving in a new school world.
But
that's what makes it. And
paired with that roster.
What's that?
They're well paired with that roster. Like, to be an old-school physical.
You know who they remind me of? Guys, this St. Louis Blues team, the one that won the Cup last year and the one that we're seeing this season, they remind me so much of the Los Angeles Kings that won 2 Stanley Cups. They're not the fastest. They may be the slowest. Mm-hmm. They are not the fastest team. They are a straight-line hockey team that works hard and has skill and doesn't play fancy.
Yeah. And I think if you had Craig Berube and Steve Ott and Mike Van Rijn coaching a team of, you know, offensive guys who wanted to play east-west and get cute, I'm not sure it would work. Which, by the way, I think is why Sheldon Keefe is having success in Toronto, because he's well-suited to coach a team like that. I'm not sure that he'd be able to coach a team like St. Louis, where the guys just are best off banging into people and going northwest or north south. So I think it's a matter of coach style fitting the roster style.
Maple Leafs, which player or which players stood out most for you guys this weekend, and why is the answer Matthews and Nylander?
I just wanted, I'll preface this by, I think Pierre Engvall is here and he's here to stay. I paid a lot of attention to him over these last two games and just how he has confidence skating, you know, through three zones with the puck full speed. I know he threw a bit of a pizza there on one of the goals against the Rangers, but seeing a guy come out of the minors have that confidence, because I remember as a player coming up and trying to get rid of the puck as quick as possible. So to have him come up, make plays, you know, get in on the forecheck, play a big, heavy game, I really like Pierre Engvall. So that's a little bit off the chart for pick, but
he was
really
the one that popped for you this weekend?
Yeah, absolutely.
For me, Tyson Barry is, you know, probably for, I think it's about 20 games now, where he's looked like what they thought they were getting. You know, it was a rough start to the year and it didn't work with Babcock, and it was, you know, he wasn't on the first power play unit and it didn't work initially, but he's been pretty good for a while here. I think he's had 8 points in his last 8 games. He's started to make some sort of creative offensive plays. Like, he's never going to be, I don't know what people expected when he came here in Toronto, you know, but he was always a good offensive player, and he's showing that again. He looks more comfortable. And if he, you know, sort of is what they thought they were getting the rest of the way, the Leafs are in a lot better shape.
The play that he made on the blue line before the Engvall tip. Go back and watch. If you haven't seen it, folks, go back and watch that play. A, to have that confidence to make that move where if you make a mistake, Capo Caco is
going the other way
on a breakaway, yeah, and just leaves Caco's jockstrap spinning. Like, that's an elite play and a confident play. Like, I don't know that Tyson Barry even tries that play.
Yeah, and that just sums up the Maple Leafs. Like, that was almost a nothing play. Like, William Nylander's coming down. He's like, okay, well, I'm going to – normally you're supposed to drive the net there and make a play. But he's like, no, I'm going to turn up, pull up. Okay, here's Tyson Barry changing here. I'm going to make a play. And it goes from a nothing play to a goal.
Yeah.
But that's an elite play. But that just shows this team under Sheldon Keefe, they have the confidence to make plays 1 or 2 feet within the blue line. So it's, I'm telling you, that's the danger zone. Usually when you have that puck there, you get tunnel vision. You're like, I do not want to make mistakes. So see these guys have that confidence that close to the blue line. Yeah. That's definitely elite.
That's why I think, though, they have success against lower quality teams, because they're not just content saying and giving it to the other team. And they're taking the time to try to create something and find holes. And there are holes. When you play the really good teams who are right on top of you and close quickly, and you say, all right, I'm used to making this play up by the blue line, you know, you can get yourself in some trouble. So that is always the juggling act. And, you know, Sheldon's teams, you know, they won a Calder Cup in the American League. So they have found their way to have success with that. But they have to find their way to be able to do it against good teams, too.
Leafs may be in the market now, as reported on headlines on Hockey Night in Canada on Saturday. Elliot Friedman joins us next to talk about some of those headlines and some of those trade targets as well. Hockey Central continues on Sportsnet 590, The Fan, Sportsnet, and the NHL Network.
Now, more Hockey Central on Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
Welcome back to the program. Merrick, Stewart, and Bourne. This is Hockey Central here Monday to Friday, noon to 2. Pretty quiet night around the NHL. Just one game, Ottawa Senators and the Pittsburgh Penguins. Meantime, Elliot Friedman from 31 Thoughts and Hockey Night in Canada joins us. Friedge, thanks so much for popping on today. I know it is always a busy time of year for you. Headlines this weekend was interesting for Maple Leafs fans specifically. For the first time, we have, as close as we have seen, some confirmation that they are in the market. What can you tell us?
Oh, yeah, well, there's no question that they're looking around. They're looking to shuffle some of their pieces, no question about it. They've made it be known that three of their players, one at the NHL level and two at the AHL level, are available. The one at the NHL level is Dmitry Timoshov, I think, who's looking to see if there's what else is out there, maybe a bigger role. At the AHL level, it's Ben Harper, who's not, I don't think, playing too much for the Marlies and just wanted to see if there was another opportunity. But the most interesting one, I think, is Jeremy Bracco. You know, Bracco's a guy who's a bit of a late bloomer, wasn't always respected in terms of his talent. at the OHL level in terms of the way NHL teams saw him. But he's really come on. He was second in the AHL in scoring last year. He's fourth in assists this year. And I think he kind of realizes that he's blocked by some pretty good players in the NHL. And he wants to see what's out there for him, if there's interest. Now, I've heard that they've had calls about him before, and therefore they're kind of they put him out there to see who else might be interested. And the thing I'm most curious about, Jeff, in this is, you know, is this them looking to move Bracco for something, or is this something that could be part of a bigger deal? I don't know the answer to that, but a couple of comments I've received after kind of make me wonder that.
So if I can do a Mulder Scully thing, what you're trying to tell me here is this may be the catnip for an even bigger deal then?
Possible. I wouldn't want to say that for sure, but it's been kind of, since I put that out there on Saturday night, I've had some people kind of wonder about that. If there is interest in Bracco, and I believe there's been some, and I've heard the ask from the Maple Leafs has been high, then I wonder if it's part of something bigger.
I'm going to throw this one to Justin Bourne because you would have known him from the Marlies days as well. I watched him plenty in the OHL and then the American League. Elite-level passer. Like, vision is off the charts.
Yeah, no, he's ridiculously talented. But as Elliot said, like, he's just, he does so much of what the Leafs already have, right? Like, he'd be a creative guy in the power play off the flank, which is, like, exactly what they don't need. So it makes sense to be looking to move from a position of strength to shore things up somewhere else. Elliot, well, while we're talking trade and potential trades, we were talking about the Edmonton Oilers a little bit earlier today and where they're at. They seem frustrated and their leadership seems frustrated and, things kind of seem to be regressing back to where it's been in the past, past decade, really. Is there any sense that this team wants to move on and get active and try to make a move to try to push for playoffs this season?
I think they've looked at it, Justin. They looked at Hall. They weren't willing to do I know that they are worried about the two picks that Arizona gave up, the first and the third. We did this last week on Hockey Night, but if you look at their drafts the last 5 years, they've only had one full draft during that time. And while we know that just because you have picks doesn't mean that you hit with them all, you don't want to give up those lottery tickets, right? And I know they were really concerned about the first and the conditional third that could become a second or a first. And I also believe New Jersey asked that one of their three top young defense prospects be in the deal, and Edmonton was not willing to do that. And that's Broberg, that's Bouchard, and that's Samarukov. Edmonton was not willing to include those players for a rental. Now, I also think that Edmonton is one of the teams that's looked at Brandon Saad, who is injured right now, but there's been some interest around him. However, you know, Saad's under contract for one more year. I don't think they can make it work at the number, which is the $6 million range. So I think they're looking, but one guy I kind of wonder about if they're going to be in on is going to be a guy like Toffoli. But I think they're looking. I think it's just a matter of, A, what it's going to cost them, and B, can they make it work in a very tight cap structure?
You know what? Really quickly on the Saad idea, that one to me would fit hand to glove with the Oilers, considering his strong suit is 5-on-5, and Elliot, as you all know, that's where they need most of support and help. No,
I don't disagree with you, Jeff. I just hear they can't make that work. Like the money just doesn't work. So whatever Chicago's willing to take back or whatever the situation is, I just heard they can't make it fit.
Elliot, staying in the Pacific here, with four wins in a row and a 49-save performance, Jacob Markstrom, is there any update on the contract negotiations? Are they any closer with the Vancouver Canucks?
No, Anthony, they aren't. And someone from Vancouver, a friend of mine lives out there, he says, like, okay, he called me after the game on Friday night as I was driving home, and he's like, okay, we know you love Markstrom. Like, stop pumping him every week. It's ridiculous. but he... I think they have made it very clear that they want to re-sign him. I think Vancouver is in a tough position because of the Luongo cap recapture and some of their contracts. I think that they are going to start. I don't get the sense they started talking to him in depth yet. And one of the reasons was everything Markstrom went through the beginning of the season with his father's illness and passing. I think they wanted to respect his time. But I've heard they've made it very clear that they want to keep him and they want to get it done. You know, Anthony, as you know, the number's only going up, right?
Yeah.
But I think the Canucks have some issues cap-wise, and they have to kind of figure out their business. I believe they will get to it. I don't think they're going to get any other business done until they decide what's going to happen with him. I expect those conversations will start early in the new year, but to my best intel, they have not started significantly yet.
Yesterday, Elliot, on Rogers Hometown Hockey, we saw what $20 million worth of goaltenders looks like, and it didn't look good. From the Montreal point of view, how much of a concern is that internally, and where's the general manager at on his team right now?
Well, look, how many goals did they score this weekend? 9?
Yeah.
And they went 0-2, and they didn't get a point. Like, that's not supposed to happen in this day and age in the NHL. If you score 4.5 goals in 2 games, you think you're getting a split, right?
Yeah.
So I think that's a big concern. I mean, Montreal is a team. They're so up and down. They'll have a great week. They'll have a bad week. They'll have a great week. They'll have a bad week. And in situations where you don't necessarily expect it, the GM there, he's made it very clear. He's not trading his prospects. He's riding this out. He believes in Price, even though Price had a rough weekend. I think at times he's been looking for a left shot D. I think, my guess is he'd love to be on a guy like Kreider, but I'm not convinced that. I think Kreider has a limited no trade, yeah. And I would guess that Montreal's on it. I'm not so sure he'd be interested in that. I think he's looked for a left-hand shot D, and I think he'll continue to try that. But he's made it very clear he's not trading his prospects.
See, here's part of the frustration if I'm a Montreal Canadiens fan, here's my frustration. I'm looking at the Montreal Canadiens and I'm saying to myself, okay, now finally we're starting to see what the future of the center ice position is going to look like in Montreal. And it looks good. It looks good for the first time, Elliot, in who knows how long. The problem is when those players actualize as legitimate, significant NHL guys consistently, where are players like Weber and Petrie and Carey Price going to be? And at that point, are we ending the conversation about centers and starting the conversation about defensemen and goaltenders, namely, where are they?
Well, they've still got Price under contract for a long time.
I understand that, but I'm just talking about performance.
Well, I mean, yeah, I totally get it. Weber's having a renaissance. I mean, you're always worried about with him the injuries because his body's been through so much. But I'm less worried about him and Petrie than I would be at least this week worried about Price.
Mm-hmm.
That was a bad weekend for Price we talked about. I think that team needs some beef. I don't think size is the most important thing in the NHL anymore, but I think you need to have some of it. And I really think that they could use some, and I think that's why they could potentially be interested and someone like a Kreider, although, like I said, I don't think that's very likely.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I agree with you, Jeff, and I think Weber and Price have made that very clear that we've got to do something while we're still able to be factors.
Right.
But, hey, on a weekend like this, you're looking at Price this weekend, you're saying we need more than that.
Elliot, I can't sit here and have us all talking about the Montreal Canadiens and not wonder about Marc Bergevin and his job and, if there aren't points where it would be up in question. I'm going to ask you a fairly tough question here because I thought the same thing when you're talking about Vancouver and Jim Benning. And we always talk about coaches that are on hot seats. And not, it's tougher to GM out of desperation, but do you get the sense there are any GMs around the league, whether it be Benning or Bergevin, or even guys who are more tenured like Poyle or Doug Wilson or Bob Murray, are any of these guys in a position now you think that they're fairly close to saying, all right, I need to do something for the sake of my job this season?
I think a lot of people in Vancouver have wondered about that with Benning. Benning got an extension in the summer. He had 1 year left this year. He got extended. But the ownership there has shown absolutely no fear of making changes. You know, Mike Gillis was fired there, I think, with 4 years left on his contract. And I think people in Vancouver have absolutely worried about that. Now, they're hot this week, so everything's calmed down. But I've looked at Vancouver and I've said, what's the desperation deal you're going to make there? Like, you're not trading Pettersson. You're not trading Markstrom. You're not trading Hughes. You're not trading Besser. I mean, I don't know. Your first-round pick is tied up in JT Miller. Like, I don't know what the desperation deal is there. I have wondered about Bergevin, too, just in the sense that, you know, they haven't made the playoffs in 3 years, and the Canadians don't miss the playoffs for 4 years in a row. It's just not allowed in franchise history. But, you know, he's not acting like a guy who's panicking. And I'll tell you this, like, I have spoken to guys, Justin, about situations like this now. And, you know, with the way that we kind of look at trades and in the sense that you take a look at guys who've been tagged now with trades that didn't work and it becomes part of your legacy, I think guys are much more aware of now that if you make that kind of a deal and it blows up in your face, we don't forget as easily as we used to.
So, and are you saying that more GMs are gun shy now than ever before?
I think they're more aware of, you know, they're just more aware of that the legacy stays with you longer.
Hmm.
I don't think I would say gun shy, because I think some guys will still do it, but I think they know that, you know, people, I don't know if social media's done it or there's more voices or, you know, I just get a sense that they're aware that the tough deals, they stay with you longer than maybe they used to. I don't know if it's right or wrong, but that's the way a lot of these guys feel.
I think you're right, though, on the internet. Dan Carlin refers to it as digital stone. And once it's there, it's there forever. Elliot, thanks as always for stopping by. We'll check in soon.
All right, guys. Take care.
There he is. Elliot Friedman from 31 Thoughts and Hockey Night in Canada. Some interesting notes. Mm-hmm. There is always and more. I do wonder about that with Montreal, though, guys. As we get to break here, quick around the table on this one. It has to be endlessly frustrating, finally starting to see, okay, this is what that forward group is going to look like. This is tempting. This is fantastic. And then you realize, okay, but when they're there, are these guys going to have aged out, namely our top two blue liners?
Yeah, as you mentioned, like Kotkaniemi is looking like a quality piece, and Suzuki's there, and all right, that's what it's going to be down the middle, and there is some, even Philip Deneau is not old. You
25, 26?
Right, there. So you start to see that forward group that, boy, as they get older, they're going to be good, but as they get older, yeah, you lose Price and Petrie.
Yeah, I think the team really rests on the shoulders of Carey Price, and when he's on, he's on, but when he's not been on, he's really not been on. So time will tell how they're going to do in Montreal.
That is tough. That is challenging. All right. We'll hit it and come back with, okay, we're sort of gimmicking up the show today and dovetailing on your latest piece in The Athletic. We're just going to steal questions from your mailbag and roundtable all of them.
It's great.
How about that? This is that awkward week in between Christmas and New Year's and getting going again, and January's on the horizon.
What day is it today?
Well, gimmick it up. It's the 30th.
What year is it?
2019. 2020 is on the horizon, A. Stewart. Hit a break. Hockey Central. More of it in moments. Sportsnet 590, the Fan Simulcast on Sportsnet and the NHL Network.
More Hockey Central on Sportsnet 590, the Fan.
All right, back on the air, Monday to Friday, noon to 2. It is Hockey Central. Jeff Merrick, Anthony Stewart, and Justin Bourne. We're stealing your mailbag.
Fine.
All right?
Yeah.
You okay about that?
Yeah, you know, it doesn't affect me much.
All right. No, we're getting you to expand on some of your
PR. Yes.
We're getting Stewie's thoughts on this one as well.
Yes.
And so this is from your most recent mailbag at The Athletic. I'm going to pick a really good one that Stewie can chomp on, too. How about this one? Why don't teams rest their starter if it's an absolute blowout after two periods?
I thought that was a very good question.
Treat your goaltenders like pitchers.
Yeah.
You're going to give us six innings, maybe seven, and then you're sitting down.
I think it's a respect factor to the backup goalie. It's almost like at the end of the game when I'm still waiting for the password, by the way. It's like a fourth line guy that's been sitting a whole entire period, and then you get the insurance goal and you put him out with 12 seconds left. It's pretty disrespectful. So I think that's the same thing with goaltenders. You want them to, hockey's about preparation. You don't want them going in cold. You want them to have a full, unless it's coming in relief of a bad game, you want them coming in mentally and physically prepared.
But isn't this a definition, or shouldn't this be the definition of a backup goaltender? Providing relief for your, or are we thinking about goaltenders?
You should have a whole bullpen. You should be able to have multiple backups.
I think you should have expanded roster, like for games. But that's a whole other discussion. But isn't that, or shouldn't that be the definition of what a backup goaltender does? Like, you know, you see with players, like the Maple Leafs are up 6-2 on a team or 8-2 on a team. I know that Matthews and Marner and John Tavares are getting big minutes in the third period.
Have you seen teams now, especially in this day and age, are coming back from 3-4 goal deficits? Florida's done it, I think, four times this year. So I don't think you put a cold goalie in sort of off the cuff, you can lose that lead.
I do like the idea of having like a bullpen for your backup goalies, like where they like a patch of ice where they go and face pucks because they know like
you call the guy up from the minors at Rico. Hey, we know you're at the bar watching the game. Yeah. We're going to need you for the third.
Remember, I was at a game once when I was doing it with John Bartlett and Wayne Cowley got called. So Wayne owns
shout out to the bottom line,
over on Front Street, and Cowley. I can't remember which team it was, but Cowley got the call. To back up at
David
the Ben,
Lang
the Ben
told me
Rico.
That he told me a story. He got called. He was at the local establishment.
No,
St. John's.
Come on.
And I think it was Ferguson. I think called him. And he's like, yeah, right. And he hung up. So they called
didn't
back.
Think it was Ferguson?
No, he thought it was one of the guys pranking him.
That's amazing.
There was no cell phones back then. This was.
How about this one? This in light of something we haven't talked about yet, and that's a situation with Ilya Mikheyev. Should we all just fully get on board with a world where everyone can just kick the puck in? Nothing worse than a review where it goes against common sense.
That's from our buddy Andrew Walker, by the way.
Oh, is that from Walks?
Yeah.
Out in Vancouver?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
I'll leave it to Stewie because I've answered it and I'll follow up.
No. I've been part of the Florida organization where we saw the Richard Zednik. Situation. I played with Martin Tuma, who got his wrist slit in Rochester, and it literally went into his visor. It's very, very scary. It's very, very, it's gross. It's gross. Yeah. And I think now this is up to the companies now to sort of worry about player safety first. I was the first one to say, why did they worry about making skates lighter as opposed to more protective? Because if they would have done this 15, 20 years ago, worry about protection first and then go to weight, there'd be a lot less broken feet. But with the blades, you know, I got a scar to this day from a skate. It's very, very frightening. So I think that the companies need to sort of pay a little bit closer attention to making players safer out there.
Yeah, I've heard, I said the same thing, but I've heard from people, I forget where I heard it, but that the idea of if you keep a part of your skate blade on the ice, it should be okay. So if you're not swinging your foot back, but I know now we're getting into it.
So you get cross-checked in the back.
I just don't want anyone, I'm with you, I just don't want anyone encouraged to kick pucks around goalies' hands when they're down smothering.
Jeff recommended that we go to rollerblades. That's our play. I remember.
You look at the kind of rules package I want you to swear it is, the old RHI. Hey, Anaheim Bullfrogs, Grant Saunier, come on down. Here we go. Toronto Planets back at it.
But I just don't think you can do it. How many times have you seen a goalie go to cover the puck and you've been like, I can get my stick in there, and you make that last second poke for it, he covers it. And what if you do that with a skate? I mean,
let's pick up that conversation about Ilya Mikheyev and his cut next on Hockey Central.
It's Hockey Central with Jeff Merrick, Anthony Stewart, and Justin Bourne on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
Welcome to hour two of the program. Justin Bourne, an update on John Tortorella after the tirade yesterday about officiating in the Chicago Blackhawks game.
Yeah, their beat writer Aaron Portsline said, John Tortorella opens his post-practice chat with a mea culpa, saying he showed a lack of discipline by airing his grievances with NHL officiating in public rather than dealing with it behind the scenes.
Translation?
I got a phone call.
How is that be?
I'm a little bit later in the pocketbook because of, also for Columbus, Jonas Korpisalo will be out weeks.
Yeesh.
That is a
big 1.1 seconds.
Oh, man. You can understand the frustration with the domino effect of what happened when the time wasn't put back on the clock and the Werenski goal would have counted and there wouldn't have been a overtime or shootout. The goalie would. I understand all that. I get all that. I don't know. Do you guys want an NHL world where you're allowed to call out officials like that?
Sure, why not? I mean,
I love. Yeah, go ahead.
Because they're part of the play, right?
It would be every game.
Yeah,
you do understand that.
But wouldn't that just numb us to it? Like, sore losers again, that sort of thing.
I'd love a hockey world, not just an NHL world. But with the officiating, all you want is consistency, right? You want consistency. If you're going to call something
That's impossible. Why not? Because you have so many different officials, and we all look at the rule book and say, okay, well, they're the rules. Now let's just call them. But if you called every single play by the rule book, it would be 60 minutes of power play. Like, there's always
consistency
going to be
within the game. If you're going to call a headshot in the first period, you can't say, there's 5 minutes left in the third. We're going to let it go. You got to call it's consistency within the game.
I think that gets complicated when you consider things like managing a game. If you're
where's Koharski? I want to talk to him.
Right now. Bring me Koharski.
Well, you know, and listen, we do this on Wednesdays on Scotiabank Wednesday Night Hockey. It's called Brian Burke's First Call. First Call with Brian Burke. And the NHL, Berkey always maintained this, are very specific about wanting the first call in the game to be as legitimate a call, because that sets the template for the rest of the game. Like, that is the standard. So if it's a ticky-tack, nothing kind of tiny little tug or something like that, and it gets called, you understand the frustration.
You hear that, because NHL players cheat early. They're not looking to call those ones.
Well, no, like, you want it to be a legitimate call, because that's, and I'm sure, you know, if Stephen Walken were sitting in that chair beside you right now, I said, you want that first call to be as legitimate as possible. He'll tell you, yeah, we want that to be a legitimate, like, yes, that is a penalty, which is probably why generally you don't see the first call until it gets deep into the first period.
Speaking of calls, what would you call that? So this is in the KHL.
Oh, I saw this. So he got two game suspension.
That's a two game suspension. So what league is that in?
A KHL.
What a league.
That's a little stick check.
Yeah. So that's what I'm saying. If that's a two game suspension, I'd hate to see a four game or a five game. So that's the thing. It's tough that they're all over the map.
Glad you showed me that on your phone on the radio.
Yeah, it's a radio show. It's televised.
Use your imagination.
Yeah. Okay, so there's the update with Columbus. We're talking about skates and bodies and skin and slashes and cuts and Ilya Mikheyev of the Toronto Maple Leafs. And it looks like just an innocent enough play. Jesper Bratt's skate comes up, catches Mikheyev on the wrist, and he goes off. Now, anything around skates and the body, everyone is very sensitive to. You mentioned the Richard Zednik situation. We can all remember Steve Tuttle and Clint Malarchuk. And there are countless other episodes, Matt Cook and Eric Carlson, countless other episodes of players getting cut with skates. Skates are sharper than ever. The game is faster than ever. When I see a lot of body checks right now, guys, and I see bodies going up and players moving their bodies in different positions and seeing skates leave the ice and skates getting high, I get fidgety. I get real fidgety. And even when I'll tell you what, I don't know about you guys, but every time I see Travis Dermott play, Travis Dermott rolls up the sleeves. Mm-hmm. It's a cool look, right? Like, I still do it in men's league. I look like a dummy. I
hero.
Know. Right, you roll the sleeves up, have the elbow pad is still exposed. It's a cool look, right? Every time I see it, I'm like, you're playing in the NHL.
A lot of flesh.
Exposed skin, like, oh, geez, I don't know. First of all, we'll have the expanded conversation about Kevlar and, you know, what this means for the NHL, et cetera. But this one is, I don't want to say it's disastrous for the Toronto Maple Leafs, but this is a significant injury.
Yeah.
For the Toronto Maple Leafs. Yeah. Like, Mikheyev has been playing sensational, hasn't he?
Yeah, but the scary part is it could happen to anybody at any given time in the NHL. And again, I got a skate in the face. It happened in the British League during the lockout that people don't understand. The skate blade, it has two fine edges.
Yeah.
And I actually got two cuts. And because of the skin in between, they couldn't sew it. So I just had to basically I looked like the joke.
Oh, yeah.
They couldn't even sew it. Yeah, they couldn't even sew it. So it's very scary when skates come up. And I told the story earlier about my father-in-law moving to Canada from Barbados. And he's like, how is there not an injury like this every game or something like that? The game is so fast. It's so quick. It's so explosive that it's surprising and shocking that this doesn't happen. So I think the league needs to take a look at it and have cut-proof jerseys, have cut-proof socks. Like, how many times do you see a guy's getting a skate on the back of the thing, almost cutting their Achilles? That's a big thing. So I think now there's a window here to try to get it right. I know guys want to have this, you know, be stylish out there. And I'm a guy that played without a visor, and it's a miracle that I didn't have any eye injuries or any major facial injuries. So I think now they got to trend towards being more protective as opposed to style.
Well, there, one of the things I was looking for on my phone, I couldn't find it, but Chris Johnston mentioned in headlines over the weekend that there is a task force, a NHL, like a cut task force, where they're a group of people, I believe Joe Riecke of the NHLPA is involved, and they're trying to find new ways to protect players, particularly wrists and Achilles tendons, which are very vulnerable. You would think that there would be some way to weave Kevlar into these sweaters and socks, and that might get expensive, but it's the NHL.
Yeah.
So it is interesting, and I know if I were a player now, I would be hyper aware of the dangers, just because, like you said, the game is so fast. Skates are coming up more than ever. I think the risk is higher than ever, and certainly players need to be wary of that.
But are you not weighing off danger versus comfort?
I just don't even think when it comes to skate blades, that's a... I think you're talking about a sleeve.
Like, I understand that. You know? I understand that, but you know how players are about... And one of the things that I've heard, I don't like the way it feels. Now, listen, the retort is always, well, I'm sure you wouldn't like how it feels if a skate machetes its way through your tendon.
Players complain basically how things look. And I told this before about... when they put the numbers on the front of the helmet, we were freaking out. We're not doing that. We're going to sit out. We're not coming back. We're locking this thing out for the whole season. We're not wearing numbers on the front of our helmet.
We're not football players.
And then sure enough, you see numbers on the front of your helmet. It doesn't even matter. So I guarantee you, if everyone has to do it, it's mandatory, just like they're grandfathering the visors in. I guarantee you within 5-6 years, depending on how many years O'Reilly plays, everyone's going to be wearing a visor. So it's something you're not even going to remember years down the line.
I will say, you know, just thinking about looks, I saw part of the task force was that they also next year have approved a turtleneck, like a mock turtleneck, that protective Kevlar or whatever. And I was like, no, nope, wouldn't do it. It's like your throat and your jugular. Yeah.
And I remember back in the day, you had to have a BNQ certified neck guard, and those were more expensive. And I had the
BNQ.
I had the big white Cooper one. And they're like, sir, your son can't play. And he's like, I'm not paying $50 for a neck guard. I don't care if it's BNQ certified. So we actually wrote BNQ on the big white Cooper neck
just
guard.
Just like a scarf from the bay with BNQ and Sharpie.
But that's just it too. Like a lot of it is like to the point about turtlenecks. Like that makes so much sense to me. Go watch the Richard Zedneck video. Like it is.
But here's
horrifying.
Counterpoint though, Jeff. It doesn't look cool.
You know what? Taylor Hall thought it was pretty cool to skate around without his helmet and visor on until Corey Potter stepped on his face.
Yeah. And it looked super cool. He was right.
People thought it was cool to wear Cooperalls. So that's not cool.
Yeah, swing and a miss.
But is that just it? Like, it has to be deeper than that. It just doesn't look cool.
Well,
how about we
take
it a step further? And again, I was a guy that had skates at 5/8 sharp. How about we make the blades a little less sharp?
Well, that is a thing, I think, a trend, but I don't know if they would do it for safety purposes. It only cuts so deep.
Or we go rollerblades.
Rollerblades is the best option here. Let's take this to the cement.
Bringing this all back to my RHI argument I've been making for all these years, guys. I don't know what the solution is other than making things like for any type of exposed skin. And we all know guys have short cuff gloves now, and they have for the last however many years. Making that mandatory. And I can see the pushback. Like, I understand, like, when you're playing at, because I'm just looking at it from my little rec league level, right? It makes no sense. Like, I don't like wearing a cage when I play rec league hockey. It feels great to have nothing in front of your face. But I know that if I get a puck in the face or if I get a stick, I'm going to show up at work and have to explain why I wasn't
looking like you got beat up.
Listen, I'm not pretty to begin with. I need all the help I can get. But at the professional level, like where it's like 700 players, like that's it, that are playing in the NHL, I understand I need to have the most high performance equipment. I need to feel as comfortable as possible or I don't feel safe.
And you can argue that having no visor might be safer for some players if you feel like you have better vision or better peripheral view of the ice. I get it in some cases. The Kevlar stuff, that to me, there's very little argument against it. Like you said, the derma thing is, now that I think about it, pretty ridiculous. And gloves are so short now. That's an awful lot.
Do you not think that when you see Dermot?
Yeah.
Short cuffs, yeah. Shirt pulled up.
I used to love when guys do that because I would give them a little chop off the face off, chop their wrists off.
Yeah. The target for you?
Oh, yeah.
My dad played for the Kings there in 87, 88 and was in practice and fell and his glove came off and someone skated over the back of his wrist. That affects you for the rest of your life. His tendons all curled back. One of his fingers doesn't pick up like it used to. Like, that's nothing to mess around with. Ilya Mikheyev, like, hopefully all is well here, but there's certainly no guarantee things are going to feel the same for him when he's back. I mean, most likely, but that's scary stuff right there.
You worn Kevlar socks?
Yeah, I did, actually. Yeah.
Did you like them?
Yeah, you can't tell the difference.
So, because I've talked
you
to...
You honestly can't
honestly,
tell the
I've
difference.
I've talked to people that say, oh, yeah, it doesn't feel good
but
wearing them.
When I played, I think everyone wore them. They're literally, they have them thin, and it's a little extra protection on the back, but it's I still have them to this day.
He's wearing them right now.
I'm wearing them now. Yeah. You never know.
Fresh off the runways.
Kevlar Gooch, yeah.
Fresh off the runways of Scarborough. Yeah, here he is.
Right, got him right from Byway, yeah.
Kevlar socks.
Let's start a company right now. We should start selling them.
You don't think that there's
Kevlar underwear
already all over this?
Yeah, I know.
We can beat them to the punch. Let's do it.
But we got the number one target. You know, we can give it to Chris right now. You can put them on. Get rich overnight. Let's do it.
So that's a tough loss for the Maple Leafs. They also lose Jake Muzzin, which is, we were talking about this off air as well. He brings something to that Maple Leafs blue line that nobody else does.
Yeah, that's a big one.
Week to week.
Yeah, and I've made the case before on this very network that outside Freddie Anderson, Muzzin might be their most important player. Not their best player, but just the guy they lean on the most to play a certain style of game that they don't really have. They don't get from anywhere else. But it's interesting we're talking about Dermott because he's a guy who everyone has kind of thought, okay, he could be a top four guy. He just needs opportunity. He needs some time to develop. Okay. You know, what do you got? We're halfway through his, third season here. This is a big moment for him to show that he can play a more responsible game and be effective in those minutes. But it doesn't change the fact that, boy, they're going to miss Jake Muzzin.
Yeah, when they were down in a lull, you know, losing those games, he scored some big goals during that time. True. And he weathered the storm. And, you know, we talked about next to Freddie Anderson, he was probably the MVP and talking about you have to extend him. So this injury definitely is a big blow to the Toronto Maple Leafs. But like you mentioned, it's an opportunity for guys like Dermott and CeCe to step up now because you're playing for contracts. Now's the time when things are going well to step up, try to jump in and maybe get some extra minutes here and there. But, you know, say what you want. Justin Hall is really grabbing this opportunity and running with it.
Big time.
Yeah.
Do you guys have a thought on Auston Matthews and the weekend that was? We saw goals number 25 and 26. And I know it was tipped, but if Auston Matthews can start scoring from that position – outside of the home plate area. We all know you score in the home plate. That's where you score the lion's share. If Matthews can start scoring consistently from their lookouts.
Yeah. It's felt to me in the past that Matthews has been like this fancy cog on the outside of the machine, you know, playing 18, 19 minutes a night while, you know, Marner and Hyman and those guys, I don't know. He just hasn't felt important enough. It feels like his team now. It feels like as he goes, they're going to go. It feels like he's a guy who can compete for the Rocket Richard. He's playing, you know, he's played his highest time on ice per game. Like six of them have come in the past month or so. He's playing a ton of minutes now for them. And hopefully, you know, that's actually something that Babcock used to say is makes him feel important. And I think you get more out of guys when they feel important.
Yeah, well, I rarely jump off my seat. But when he scored that goal and I was a little bit disappointed that it hit a stick, but it was still... Yeah. From that spot to be able to put that top shelf, it reminds me of we used to do penalty kill and try to shut that shot down from Stamkos on the other side. And he would literally score from almost touching the outside of the circle, almost in the corner. He'd put that top shelf. And that release is one of the best of all time. I don't care if you chirp me on Twitter about it. That release is deadly. That shot, there's no reason why he can't have 50 goals a year. No doubt in my mind.
Part of that, too, was, and you saw the all of a sudden, like, all the frustration just emptied out of him when he scored that goal. A lot of that, too, is missing the empty net.
Yeah.
Right before that. Like, that's the two-foot putt for Auston Matthews. Yeah,
but he's a shooter, though, and he's not just going to put a little muffin in the net. He's going to shoot it through the net. It's funny how they had the camera angle from right behind him. I'm like, how do you miss that? So I think he's a little bit embarrassed, but he made sure the next opportunity was going
Speaking
in.
Speaking of embarrassing, the Engvall celebration and skating towards him, he thought he scored was just – amazing. Matthews not only had to miss the shot and feel that pain, he had to break the news to a teammate. Yeah, like, dude,
sorry,
it's not in.
Didn't go in, guy.
Yeah.
I thought William Nylander had a hell of a weekend. I really did. And the beneficiary of all of it with, I mean, I thought John Tavares' shoulders were going to fall off. He was shooting so much, and they were pretty much all set up by William Nylander.
Yeah, it's exciting. You know, they're starting to get from him what they thought they could be getting when they gave him that contract. And it's interesting because he's had his ice time manipulated more now under Sheldon Keith than he had previously, and he seems to be responding well to it and understanding that if you perform, you'll get to play. Pretty black and white.
He's being held accountable, and I think the average, like, for the top stars in the league, you only have the puck on your stick like 58 seconds or something like that. It seems like he's had the puck on his stick for like 5 minutes a game. He's always got it. He's always making moves. He's almost like a point guard. He's making the pass, getting it back, making plays. So he's playing and outplaying his contract right now. And I'm his number one critic over this year, but I'll give credit where it's due. William Nylander's playing great hockey lately.
He really is. Can we say now that the easy part of the Maple Leaf schedule for now is over?
Yeah.
That now it gets tough. Like we talked about when the coaching change was first made. If you were looking at the schedule and saying to yourself, okay, we're going to try to set our guy up here for the best possible entry into the NHL. And it worked. Like, since Sheldon Keefe has taken over, the Maple Leafs are number one in the NHL in that segment. That segment's done now. Now it gets tougher, and the first challenge is the suddenly exciting, somehow, Minnesota Wild. Does it get tough now for Toronto?
Yeah, I think it does. But what's great is when you're a new coach and you're trying to sell to your team that my way works, you need to win. That's it's the only way to cement that, you know, your ideas are good. And it gave them, you know, playing lesser teams, for lack of a better way of putting it, allowed them to sort of feel their game out. Not that it's practice, but to try different things and see how it can have success. And that allows you to try to implement it when the game gets harder. So, yes, they're going to play some better teams, but I think they're well set up in at least finding an identity in how they want to play.
Yeah, the schedule's going to get a little bit tougher, but I'm looking right now. I don't think there's any back-to-back games in January. They only have 10 games in January. No long road trips. They're going to Florida once. They're going to Winnipeg once, coming back, playing some games at home, and then they're playing Nashville and Dallas at the end of the month. So it's not like they're going on they're having the month of November the Arizona Coyotes had, and we're hoping that they survive. So it's going to get a little bit tougher, but it's a National Hockey League. There are going to be some tough games, but the way they're playing some good hockey. They should be fine.
Elsewhere, Edmonton Oilers struggling again. We talked about this a little bit off air. We don't have much right now in Edmonton to judge Ken Holland on. There's the James Neal trade.
I heard that on Edmonton emphasis.
What's that?
I heard that emphasis on in Edmonton.
Well, his Detroit Red Wings. Like, if you're not going to criticize Ken Holland about Edmonton, and that's fair.
Yeah.
And I think you can say, like, well, look at the Gordian knot of salary cap that has, you know, handcuffed the Detroit Red Wings, and look where they're at.
Fair. Very fair.
So you can't have it. You can't have it both ways. But what is going to be the first measuring stick moment, you guys think, for Ken Holland and this team? Nurse contract, Cassian contract, a trade. As Elliot mentioned in hour one, they were looking to try to get Taylor Hall. They weren't willing to part with one of their three defensive prospects. So that didn't end up getting anywhere. Picks were an issue there as well. What's going to be a defining moment for you guys, for Ken Holland, the rest of the way here, now that his team has fallen out of the playoff picture in the West?
I think the Zach Cassian deal to me is going to be it. Like, the Hall thing was a little bit, you know, that he didn't pull the trigger on a Hall trade definitely made a statement to me. But what is Zach Cassian going to get? If he gets 4x4, boy, would that not look good? You know, if he gets 2x3, you love it. So there, you know, I'm sure there's some sort of number in the middle there, but you cannot look at Cassian's season and say that it's not thoroughly intertwined with being with Connor McDavid. So we'll see how aware they are of that.
Yeah, but what if you put a Wayne Simmons on that line? Is he still, he's going to get you 20-25,
absolutely,
right?
He is.
So
yeah, yeah.
I think with him, he's got to take probably a little bit of a hometown discount to get there, because a lot of his success, is he really going to be scoring 25-30 if he's playing for Detroit or Ottawa? I don't think so.
No.
But I think for him, for Kenny Holland, he's just going to continue doing what he was doing. We were talking about this, and we weren't, but everyone was talking in the summertime. How are they going to get rid of this cap hell? They got Sekera, they got Lucic, and no one's mentioning that. So yeah. He's quietly doing a good job. So I think they just got to continue to be, you know, cap compliant. They got to get Nurse done. I don't care what anyone says. People aren't the best fan of him, but I watch him on a nightly basis. He's the real deal defenseman. They got to get him paid. But they got to find tertiary scoring. They have the primary, secondary. Yeah. They just got to bring guys in. So I think part of the plan is they're going to continue doing it in the offseason. This year, if they make the playoffs, great, but they're not going to sell the farm to do it. They're slowly but surely going to have this rebuild and do it so they can be contenders for years to come.
Trades have never been a bullet that Ken Holland likes to use. You know, Ken Holland hasn't earned his reputation based on trades. Like, if you look at someone like Dave Poyle in Nashville, you look at Nashville's forward group, it's all trades. Like, all of it. Like, David Poyle has not been shy about pulling the trigger. Ditto for Jim Rutherford, you know, his counterpart in the Eastern Conference. They have done it with trades. Ken Holland's not that guy. So you still maintain, Stewie, that trend is going to continue?
Not through free agency? Build the team through free agency. They have some young guys coming up. Make a couple deals in the offseason. Why not?
I do remember years ago looking at the roster of the Detroit Red Wings when they were very good, and almost every player was drafted. They were of the Detroit Red Wings organization, and I think what Ken Holland did there that was good was show patience. This doesn't feel like the same. Just because that worked for him in the past, that doesn't make it the right thing to do with the Oilers. I don't know what the right answer is, but if his plan is to do what he did in Detroit.
In Detroit, they weren't auditioning to keep Lidstrom there.
Right. Yeah, no, it's a different situation.
Elephant in the room here.
Yeah.
Like, how long does Connor McDavid say, I can keep going through this?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, your case is basically there is a time limit here that they're going to put up with, the best players will put up with being
around. But it's longer than 1 year.
I agree that it's longer than 1 year, but the question becomes how long. Like, if you were Connor McDavid, just ask yourself, even as a fan, like, okay, if I'm Connor McDavid,
Ovi start winning again?
How long am I doing?
Well, when did Ovi start winning? Me of more accurately is LeBron going to Miami.
When did Stevie Y start winning again?
But it's like, all right, I'll do this for you, Cleveland. I'll go to the wall. I'll drag nobodies to the final, Cleveland. But if eventually you don't give me someone I can win with, I'm going to Miami. Eventually.
Hit a break. We'll come back with Sam Cosentino from the CHL on Sportsnet. We'll talk about some of the World Junior Hockey action, the U-20s, and a focus on the prospects we will see selected in Montreal at the NHL draft. Sam Cosentino joins us next. Hockey Central, Sportsnet 590, the Fan simulcast on Sportsnet and the NHL Network.
More Hockey Central on Sportsnet 590, the Fan.
Welcome back to the program. Jeff Merrick, Anthony Stewart, and Justin Bourne around the table here Monday to Friday, noon to 2. Pleased to be joined now by junior hockey analyst, draft guru, our junior hockey guru as well, the one and only Sam Cosentino, who joins us. And as always, his list of prospects available at sportsnet.ca. Sammy, how are you enjoying the U-20s so far?
Yeah, it's been great, especially the pool that Canada's in. I kind of predicted it was going to be that tough, and it's proven to be for sure.
It certainly has. And there have been a couple of, you know, hot-button issues around Team Canada. Certainly the Joe Valeno suspension for the headbutt, the Barrett Hayton drama with not taking off his bucket. From a Canadian point of view, and we'll open up around the rest of the tournament here in a couple of seconds, just from a performance point of view, who stood out mostly for you, Sam Cosentino?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I think Joel Hofer has to be the guy for me. I mean, he comes in relief in the Russia game, stops 20-22, made some key saves in the game against Germany this morning, really at a turning point when it was 1-0. He made two stops in a row, one on Dominic Bach, partial breakaway, then on a 2-on-1. And I think that changed the entire complexion of the game, because about a minute or two after that, Liam Foudy scored to make it 2-0, and then Canada was off and running. So probably the most impressive for a couple of reasons. A, he didn't have any international experience coming in, and the St. Louis prospect was a guy who, you know, at the start of it, a lot of people were talking about in the Western Hockey League, but pretty much an unknown everywhere else, and he's proven to be that good so far for Canada.
I wonder if you can tell us a little bit about the experience of NHL GM. Some of these guys are watching their first and maybe their only junior hockey of the year before they head into the draft and make their picks. Is it common for an NHL GM to watch that little junior? Am I overstating that? And how much does this tournament probably affect their decisions that get made in June?
Well, yeah, to answer the first part, I think, Justin, to be perfectly honest with you, overstating it a little bit. I mean, I get to a lot of junior games, and I've had several conversations with general managers at those games. I mean, I see Bob Murray. I mean, he's everywhere. I see Pierre Dorion all the time. I see Steve Yzerman in a lot of junior ranks. So I think that part is they just kind of sneak in and they don't want to be known. And maybe because outside of our schedule of 40 plus games, you're not getting the option to see those guys on TV in the rink. So I know that they're there. I know that they're watching. They tend to get to the big events. So this one, of course, would be a big event, much bigger this year with all the draft eligibles involved. The World Under 18s, which is in Plymouth this year in April, will be a heavily attended event by general managers. I saw a lot of them at our CIBC Canada-Russia series in November. So they do get around. I mean, you'd obviously want to get around a lot more, but there's also that trust factor. I mean, you're a guy who hires your head scout and the scouts beneath those guys. You have to have confidence in them, let them do their jobs. But, of course, when you're picking, especially in the first round, the general manager will likely get out and see all of the projected first-round players, at least once and probably more than that if they can hone in on a range of where they might be picking and go and see those guys quite often.
Quinton Byfield's expected to go second overall in the 2020 draft. How's this tournament been so far?
Yeah, hi, Stu. Good to talk to you. Yeah, you know what? He's been okay. I think there's a little bit more to give. Some of that has to do with opportunity. And again, you come into this tournament essentially as a double underage player, and, you know, it figures itself out pretty quickly. This is why we traditionally think of this as a 19-year-old tournament. And you look at Canada's usage of its forwards, especially when the full complement is there, of course they're going to lean heavier on their older guys. But with a couple of guys getting banged up, that opportunity presented itself a little bit more for Quinton in the game against Germany, and I thought he played well. The fact of the matter is, when you're used to playing a ton of minutes and playing all the high leverage minutes, you know you're going to get your touches and you get your opportunities. So when you get into a situation where your minutes aren't quite as much and your high leverage minutes are reduced significantly, sometimes you're guilty of trying too hard to make something happen in those limited minutes. Now, today I think he felt more comfortable because he knew that opportunity to get ice time was going to be present because of Valeno being out, because of Lafreniere being out. And, of course, with that came the confidence, and I thought he played better today.
You know, Sam Cosentino, Stewie just mentioned a couple of seconds ago, Quinton Byfield projected to go second overall. Is there a chance he goes first?
Well, I think that possibility exists because if you look at a 6'4", 215-pound center who can skate, who can play both ends of the ice, you know, maybe the face-offs and admittedly not a strong suit of his game, at least to this point, but I think that's something that you definitely can work on and become better at. But that size down the middle of the ice is so coveted. If you look at today's National Hockey League, you know, that's where it's at. Having said that, Lafreniere gives you a lot of things that the center ice position can do, simply does it from the wing. So, you know, there is always going to be that positional bias that leads towards the center, the centerman over the winger in the draft, but Lafreniere might be that one outlier case where he gets taken ahead of Byfield. But I tell you what, I love the race here moving forward. You were kind of hoping that Lafreniere would be healthy to play throughout because not only would you have him trying to prove to the world that he should be number one, but him also trying to prove to Byfield within that team dynamic that he should be number one. Unfortunately, we've only had that for, you know, a little bit of that first game against the U.S.
Outside of those big names, are there any guys that are like super high ceiling? I know a lot of guys seem like high ceiling and really low floors. Is there anyone that strikes you as overly dynamic that could, you know, by the time they're NHL players, be among the best of the bunch?
Yeah, and you know, I hearken back to more what we're seeing from the draft eligible guys. I mean, you saw Tim Stützle today. He's been an effective guy for Germany in the tournament. You know, Raymond and Holtz are the two guys that everyone talks about. With Sweden. So you do have those guys that I think have that high ceiling, low floor type of potential in them. And it's always nice when you get those guys in this collection to see what they can do in terms of point-wise, the minutes they get, whether they're getting the most important minutes or not. But there are definitely some guys there you know, right across the board that, hey, maybe he's a later pick. You know, you look at Fajimo, who's playing with Sweden right now. He's an LA Kings pick who I think has performed quite well. So you're always going to have those guys that kind of jump out in this tournament. Yet that developmental curve still has a little ways to go because some of the European players have never left Europe to play in North America. And then you look at some of the North American players who are still in the junior ranks who may have a year, maybe 2 years of seasoning in the American Hockey League. So you can look at this tournament in its entirety and say, yeah, we do have those high ceiling, low floor type of guys. And there are going to be some of them that are going to be able to step in right away and have an impact. And then you look at more of a guy like Moritz Seider, who last year is playing in the DEL, plays well, plays in the World's Men's for Germany, plays well. Then he goes over to Grand Rapids, gets to a slow start, and then starts to perform better. Yet that developmental curve for Seider is probably not a guy who's going to impact Detroit's lineup for probably two more years. So you do have those type of guys, and it's important to watch. I think this tournament here, your draft eligibles, probably a three-year window, and the guys who've been drafted, maybe that window is a two-year window before they can have an impact at the National Hockey League.
Sammy, then let me throw another wild card name out at you. Just mentioned Moritz Seider a couple of seconds ago. What should we all know about Tim Stützle?
Well, he's playing well in the DEL a lot the same way that Seider did. He's an unbelievable kid. I've been able to get some pretty good intel on him. Really good in the power play. He's a puck mover. He protects the puck well. He skates well. So I think he can impact the game in a variety of ways. Now, playing in the men's league, he doesn't get the opportunity to play his natural position at center ice. So that is also going to have an impact on where he's drafted, because if there is that belief that when he gets back to his age group, he can play the center ice position and play it well, which is his natural position, that's going to add some value to where this guy is. But, you know, you look at the way German hockey has come along, it goes back to Draisaitl. You look at Bach, who looks like he's on a nice developmental path, already traded in his, you know, his NHL rights. And then you look at Seider being picked last year. Stutzel's probably going to be a top five, maybe it slips beyond that, and for sure in the top 10. So they're really starting to come along and develop players. And, you know, that model of playing in the DEL is a little bit different than maybe people expect. Because of the schedule of games that are played there, it allows these guys some time off ice, sort of like the college route, to be able to work out, to be able to practice, and then still have enough games against men where you can have an impact and strut your stuff.
See, that's the interesting. I'm glad you touched on that, too, because we've talked, you know, countless times, and Brian Burke has been talking about this since he was with the Maple Leafs organization, that the next emerging super hockey power is Germany. And you're starting to see it now. But generally, German prospects, young kids, go to play elsewhere. You know, we saw Leon Draisaitl go and play in the Western Hockey League with finished up by playing with the Kelowna Rockets. But now you're starting to see with Seider and now with Stützle, players stay in Germany instead of playing in the Swedish League, Finnish, wherever, going to the junior hockey in Canada. We're starting to see those players have enough in their own domestic leagues to stay and not have to go elsewhere.
Well, it's good. It's good for the country. It's good for the teams in that country to be able to show off their young stars. And then it's great to get that exposure to the National Hockey League once that player gets drafted. So, again, you stay there in your first year, and if you can go and have the opportunity to play against men, you see it in Sweden a lot, you see it in the league in the Czech Republic, you see it in Finland, that if you can have an impact against men at that age, it really bodes well for you. And some people think that helps speed up that developmental curve. Now, having said all that, there's still a lot to be said about coming over and playing in North America and getting on a bus and playing a CHL type of schedule or in some cases a college type schedule. But I do believe that it's great for the country. It's great for the player to stay at home. And, you know, I can say this about Seider. I think there's been some times, this year where, hey, man, I'm just an 18-year-old kid. Here I am in the middle of, you know, Midwestern United States. Yeah, of course I'm going to miss home. I miss my buddies. I miss my old teammates in Mannheim. You know, I think that's important to realize that at that time, these guys are still kids. And so you don't want to completely miss out on the opportunity of that player being a kid. So sometimes the better option is to stay at home where you're comfortable with the food, with the schedule, with family, with friends. Allow that person that, although he's still playing pro hockey, to still be a kid. I think that's really, really important. And I think for Seider, you're starting to see how that's going to work out. The next interesting decision will be, of course, what happens with Stutzel once he gets drafted in the NHL team, how they decide to move forward with his course of development.
Stutzel, quickly, top 10?
No question. Top 5 is not a stretch.
Wow.
Everyone seems to be beating everybody in this tournament. Czech Republic's now beating U.S. 2-1. Shout out Patrick O'Sullivan. After 3 games here, who's the overwhelming? Who do you think the favorite is now to win the tournament?
Well, you're going to think I'm nuts. But I still think the Russians really are going to have a say in this thing from by the end point. It's unbelievable to think that. This is one of the best Russian teams that I think I've seen been put together. Now, they've struggled so far, but that's typical. They just rope-a-dope their way through pool play, and all of a sudden the lights turn on, and they start to make things happen once they get into medal round play. So I like where they're at. I think the Finns have been sneaky good. Some of it is a little bit of fool's gold there, playing in the weaker pool and being able to run up the score on a couple of occasions. But they play a really solid, disciplined, physical brand of hockey with enough scoring to make them have an impact. How can you discount Sweden in continuously winning 50 straight games in pool play, yet only one gold medal in 2012 to show for that? So, Stu, I believe that there's a lot of contenders here. You can't discount the U.S. Canada now has an opportunity, if they beat the Czechs, to go and win their pool. That will give them a favorable quarterfinal matchup. I still like the Russians. I mean, yeah, you can put aside Germany, I think, Switzerland, I think, Kazakhstan, Slovakia. But after that, I think it's still pretty wide open.
And Sammy, before we let you go, it is the Battle of Alberta tonight on Sportsnet, not between the Flames and the Oilers, but the Hitmen and the Oil Kings. What should we watch for tonight?
Well, pretty awesome. This will be the 8th meeting already, and they're only in the first half of the season. And there's a lot of piss and vinegar between these two clubs, as you would expect in the Battle of Alberta. Edmonton has had the upper hand over the last couple of years, 13-0, 3-0 against the Calgary Hitmen. But the Hitmen are at home. The holidays are rolling. Should be a decent crowd here. So expecting a pretty good physical affair with a little bite to it.
Looking forward to this one. You and RJ, good as always. 9 o'clock Eastern on Sportsnet. It is the Calgary Hitmen against the Edmonton Oil Kings. As always, thanks, Sammy. Talk soon.
Okay, thanks, guys. Happy New Year.
There he is, the one and only Sam Cosentino. I always maintain about Sam, more information per square second than any broadcaster in Canada. When you get, it's like we put in, we have Sammy on the Wednesday Night Hockey Show once a month, and his segment is about 2.5 minutes long, and there is more information crammed in to 2.5.
Straight dope.
It's like you put a quarter into him, and you pull the lever, and Sammy goes. There's no one like Sam Cosentino in the biz.
Yeah.
And that will break. When we come back, still 2-1?
Yeah.
Czechs beating USA right now?
Want to see it.
Some grand, get some Grand Forks memories out of you to conclude today's edition of Hockey Central. That when we return, Sportsnet 590, The Fan, Sportsnet, and the NHL Network.
More Hockey Central on Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
All right, welcome back to the program. Merrick Stewart and Bourne and Stewie, of all of us, you're the only one who can speak to us with authority about what it's like playing at the WJC, the under 20s. Grand Forks, maybe the best junior hockey team ever assembled.
It was, and it all stemmed from the year before where we had majority of the guys on that team played the year before as underagers.
Yep.
And we didn't really take it serious. We were young hotshots, all first-round draft picks, and we were beating the U.S. 3-1 in Finland the year before, and we're all planning the parade before the game was over, and we really lost focus. And that was the year that Fleury ended up shooting the puck off of Braden Coburn, and we ended up losing 4-3 to the U.S.
Shout out to who?
Shout out Patrick O'Sullivan. Yes, yes, he got credit for the goal, and he still reminds me every year around this time. But the next year, it was no nonsense. They brought in Sutter,
yeah,
and he knew what happened last year, and he came in no nonsense. He actually threatened to cut me. He's like, Stewie, you led the tournament in points the year before, and you haven't scored in 3 exhibition games. And I said, hey, being the hotshot I was, I'm like, well, you put me on a scoring line, I'll score. He's like, well, if you don't score next game, I'm going to cut you. And I'm like, okay.
Whoa.
Okay. So we played against, I think it was University of Alberta, and ended up having 2 goals. And again, I was slotted in my normal position playing with Nigel Dawes and Mike Richards. And the one thing I can say about that tournament I still remember to this day was the joy. And when you go into the NHL, it's a little bit more business, but it was the joy of playing the game of hockey, loving the game of hockey. And to this day, all those guys that are on that team, every time we see each other,
yeah,
we don't remember what happened, you know, playing against each other when, you know, when we're in Anaheim or Florida. It was that tournament. And we dominated that tournament where I think we scored 38, 39 goals for, and we only had six against. And I remember that final game against Russia, it, from the drop of the puck, the game was over. Ovechkin got knocked out first period. He was crying, and we just barraged goal after goal. I think we ended up winning 6-1, and it wasn't even close. And the one thing I could say about that team, it was during the NHL lockout, that team of 19-year-old players would be an NHL playoff team. That's how great the team was. There was the Getzlaffs, the Carters, Dion, double Dion Phaneuf was there, Brent Seabrook, and I think we could have not even had a goalie and still won. So it was that dominant of a performance. And the one thing I could say, when I watch the tournament at this time of year, I get chills just thinking about that time playing with those great players.
You know, that is really interesting. And I can remember, I think it was the Finland game, mm-hmm, when Jeff Carter had the hat trick.
Yeah.
And I remember watching the game and watching him score three goals, three distinctly different ways. And you're always looking for, like, when you watch, like, the U-20s and you're looking at these prospects, okay, what's this guy going to be like? What can he do? When one guy has the same bread and butter scoring play and he always goes back, he's like, okay, well, we know he can do that. That Finland game, when Carter scores three goals, three different ways, I looked at it and I went, man, this guy is about something.
Yeah, that tournament was his coming out party, and I think he's one of the leading scorers of all time for Team Canada. And the funny part is, I remember now, they were going to cut Corey Perry that year.
Really?
Yeah. So here they are. They said, hey, Perry, we know you're a goal-scoring guy, but we have guys that can do that. Will you be fine being the 13th forward? If you say no, we're going to send you back. But he said, hey, I want to represent my country any way I can. And he went from 13th forward to first line playing with Crosby and Bergeron. And
not bad.
And no one really knew who Bergeron was. They obviously knew because he's playing in the NHL. But just seeing him dominate and coming in down from the NHL and dominating – and Sidney Crosby, the year before, he had a bit of a role, not really, you know, producing numbers. And then the next year, him dominating men. Yeah. And people don't understand how great of a player he was because he was 17 years old,
yep,
dominating men. And again, I got by being bigger, faster, and stronger than everybody. I think I was like 6'2", 235 unofficially. That's why I was really, really good at
you
that
never
time.
Never give us your real weight. It's always what you were listed as.
What I like about that team, it wasn't just the best players in Canada. It was the right team. We had MacArthur. We had Stone. We had Dixon, Jeremy Calton, jeez, guys that could play the game, a 200-foot game. So it wasn't just the offensive guys putting them together. It was built to dominate, and we dominated from game one all the way through the tournament.
The thing that stands out to me that you talked about there is joy. You know, when you talk about the joy of hockey and the kids playing, when you watch this hockey, there's that, like, a frantic, frenetic pace that is, you can feel how much the players want it. They want to win. And I've heard someone, I think Sam, our producer here today, mentioned that like March Madness. You know, just that you can really feel that and see how much it means to these guys at every little moment.
And so, I remember I just wanted to score a goal so I can do the signature flag when you grab
did
your
you
shirt.
Get to do it?
Yeah, I did. Like, all the time. I scored all the goals that
you're
week.
You're just waiting for it, right?
Yeah, waiting for the celly.
You didn't get the chance to do the name bar.
No, you can't do that one. That was saved for Kingston.
Really quick, about 10-15 seconds, the Ralph Engelstad Arena.
Oh.
Marble floors. Like, gorgeous, right?
They're in college.
I wish I went to college to play in that arena. Amazing arena. The mahogany seats. Amazing building.
Amazing building. Amazing memories. Hockey Central returns tomorrow at noon. Only one game tonight. Enjoy it. Ottawa and Pittsburgh. Back tomorrow at 12.